This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The first two segments on our show today are about the intersection of people and technology. That's something that's a focus at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, which boasts an innovation center that works with emerging technologies like VR and AI.
When Michael Delgadio graduated from MIAD in 2001, that sort of work either didn't exist or it was in its infancy. Delgadio rode the technology wave and is now the UX or user interface design lead at Google. He was back at his alma mater this week to give a lecture at the MIAD Creativity Series, and he joined us in the studio. Michael Delgadio, welcome to the show. Michael Delgadio, it is such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So if you and I were sitting on a plane together and I asked you, what do you do? What would you tell me? How would you describe what it is you do?
I think that in the most relatable way, I generally tell people that I make technology easy to use.
Okay. So talk a little bit more about that. Making a cell phone easier to use, making what easier to use?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a number of technology products in our lives. And as you know, technology has become more prolific, you know, throughout everyone's lives. And it's often the case that it's not immediate how we should use that as human beings. And so as engineers develop the technology, it can become kind of an abstract idea of what we're supposed to do with it, and it can become complicated. And so what I fundamentally do as a UX designer is make technology easy to use for everyone.
So in a way, you're an intermediary. You're trying to interpret what the engineers are doing to get the product to me, the consumer, so that I might have an idea of what I might do with it.
Yeah, and I would actually flip that around a little bit. I think that sometimes we are doing that, where we're trying to understand, you know, the intent of engineering. Other times, which is more likely the case, we are trying to understand what people are trying to achieve and how they perceive things. And we're trying to understand potential pain points in what they're trying to do. So that we can also build products based on those expectations and those understandings of how the world works.
But still, you're sort of in that nexus point,
exactly.
You know, where things are coming at you from both perspectives, and it's up to you to make it all somehow make sense.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that you can say that that's me. And I would also take that to the next level and say that as a UX designer, we often work on interfaces to technology. And I would say that that interface is actually that nexus point where it needs to come together to make it a relatable product.
Well, and relatable and usable for the average person who a lot of people might say, well, I have no idea what I would use that for. I can remember when I got my first Mac computer in the 80s, you know, thinking, well, I'll write papers on this.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea because it just didn't occur to me. Even though I was a big science fiction reader, mm-hmm. I had no idea what else it could be used for.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's a failure of imagination on my part or just not really understanding.
And I would say that it's definitely not a failure on your part. I think that we shouldn't blame users for being unimaginative. I don't think that we should blame users for not understanding how to do something. I would say that that's actually a failure of the product. I think that also, you know, in that example, computers were really basic back then. You know, they were made for writing papers. The internet was made for sharing documents at first. And we've come a long way, right? Computation has gotten a lot faster. It's become a lot cheaper. It's become a lot more embedded, you know, into our lives. It's in our pockets. It's in our cars. It's in our homes. And I think that as that's happened, just the number of things that you can do with it has really just, you know, transformed everything that we do, every aspect of our lives.
You graduated from MIAD almost 20 years ago now with a degree in its communications.
Communication design.
Yeah. And so in 2001, when you graduated, what were the kinds of problems you were looking to solve and how have they changed almost 20 years later?
That's a great question. So I'll take it even a step back further. I think that, you know, looking back at the last 20, 25 years of my career, I think that it really kind of started in high school when I began getting interested in the web. And so that was around, you know, 1995, 1996. And there was a program called Graduation Challenge. And what we had to do in high school was work with a mentor in the community to make something and then present that something back to our class. And that really, you know, set me off as being interested in the web. And so then arriving at MyAd, I thought, well, you know, I like making websites. That was kind of fun. And how could I really start to combine that with the idea of design? And this was pre-phone. This was pre-mobile, pre-wearable.
Phones were there, but they were like little basic Nokia handsets that you could
text on them. You could play Snake, you know. if you remember that
game. It looked DOS-based. Yeah.
But that was kind of where I started to bring those two ideas together, really thinking about the web and the internet and thinking about design and how I could apply those things. That was really where my mind was at. Back then, we were thinking about, we were in class making, you know, CD-ROMs, interactive CD-ROMs. And it occurred to me on the plane ride out here, I was looking at Spotify, and Spotify just released version 80, right? I believe it was version 80. You know, if we were going to go back and do that with CDs, right? So like thinking about the distribution of floppies and the distribution of software and how you had to get disks and kind of load them into the computers. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
And, you know, things have really, really progressed significantly, you know, to say the least. But, you know, then it was really about creating interactivity that was a little bit more contained. Again, thinking about, you know, interactive CD-ROMs and interactive websites, but it wasn't, you know, to the scale in terms of, you know, what I'm doing now.
Where everything is sort of cloud-based now and everything is interconnected in a way where you don't have those discrete things like a CD.
Yeah, that's true.
It's all available elsewhere. It's on an app or it's on the cloud or something.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's largely true. I think that, you know, one of the things that we often talk about in design circles is, like, where is the, you know, intelligence happening? And so I think that there is a desire to have some of it localized but actually, like, be distributed, you know, on the cloud. So it's a little bit of a blend, you know.
Design is such an interesting term to me because, you know, design can mean literally the design of this paper holder that's sitting here to the design of a brand new application that will do something that I can't even imagine yet and everything in between. And it's like design is a way that we interact with the world or try to make sense of the world.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. I think that, you know, back to your comment earlier about design and myself being an intermediary in terms of, you know, playing a role in how people should expect to use things. Because there's codified, you know, signifiers that we interpret about how we expect something to act and behave. And whether that is a door or an app or a piece of consumer electronics, like all these things have signals to us as to what we can expect them to do, how they should act, and how we should interact with them.
Well, and that explains why people get so angry when things change in a new version of a program that they're used to, and they want, well, the printing icon is supposed to be here. It's not supposed to be over there, or I'm supposed to do something this way, and it's asking me to relearn that.
Yep, absolutely. We definitely do fall into, you know, patterns of behavior, and behavior change is really, really difficult. I know that various companies and software groups have gone through that challenge where, you know, sometimes the approach isn't so much that we're going to redesign something, you know, from the ground up because people can get lost in that transition. But sometimes we think about incremental change and how we can kind of nudge that behavior in one way or another because, like you said, behavior change is really difficult. And once somebody learns how to do something, they expect that thing to continue to be there. And you can see that sometimes, you know, when you change your password, there's actually muscle memory. You go to type the old password because your fingers are used to doing it exactly that way.
So, and you're also somewhat of a psychologist as well. You have to be thinking about how people work.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I'm a psychologist, but I do think that we try to understand how people perceive things, and whether that's understanding the mental model of how something works. You know, for example, we often talk to people, right? And so we often talk to people about how they expect products to work or what they think something should do so that we can make them better. And, you know, people's understanding of how things work as we've gone to a more cloud-based computation model has really, been impacted by how they perceived things like the iPod to listen to music. So, for example, as we've moved from something like the iPod to a connected speaker like Google Home, which is completely cloud-based, you don't have to download things to it, right? And so, the mental model of, there was this thing that I had to download my music to so I could listen to a speaker that automatically does that magically for me, on demand, are two different mental models, right? And so we try to understand, what is people's perception of how something should work so that we can, again, make better products for them.
Right, and get them to use the products that are coming, because if people resist and say, no, I don't want that, I want to be able to download, I want my control, or whatever mm-hmm. it is that they're thinking that they have with the older way of doing things, mm-hmm. then, you're having to negotiate that resistance, too.
Yeah, it's true.
What are some of the things you're working on right now that excite you the most?
Yeah, so I work at Google currently. I'm a UX manager for the Android TV team. So within Android, there's a number of different product verticals. We work on everything from phones to cars to maybe Android Auto to televisions. And so I recently became the lead for the group. And I'm really excited about reimagining television, honestly. We have a number of existing products that we're working on improving, but I think that, Google has a lot of interesting pieces, whether that's Google Assistant or Search, that we think can make a better offering in the living room for what Google can do on TV. And so that's really what excites me now, and that's one thing that I'm really passionate about figuring out over the next few years.
So if I'm a TV viewer and I'm using a Google product or an Android product, what kinds of changes can I expect, or what kinds of options can I expect as a TV viewer in the next few years?
Well, I think that, as we've seen the introduction of the Google Assistant into different services and into different products, I think TV's been a little bit, behind. And so one of the things that our partners are really excited about is bringing the Google Assistant into the television. And so, I think the most immediate gain from that is being able to just voice search. So just say, I want to watch X thing, and it'll immediately bring it to you. However, I think that there's a lot more opportunity, right? And so if we look at how the assistant works on a connected speaker, it can do a lot more than that, right? It can answer things for you. It can answer questions for you. It can provide information for you. It can give you proactive pieces of information about your commute times. And so there's things like that I don't think have been solved in the living room. And so I'm excited about trying to understand those aspects of what Google can do for consumers in that space.
Going back to the science fiction idea, do you envision a time in the relatively near future where the entire house is basically interactive and wired? Or maybe wired is the wrong word. I'm thinking cloud, or I'm thinking, where, you can basically say, boil the water and do this, and the house kind of interacts with you?
That's a really interesting question. I think that there are aspects of automation that are highly beneficial. I think that right now we are in a place where I would call it transitional, where there are a lot of competing products and protocols that don't necessarily work together. I think that we'll look back on this time and see how kind of messy it is. The metaphor that I like to use is I know that we were talking about computers in the 80s before, but before we had USB, it was really difficult to plug different things into your computer, and you had to download drivers, and you couldn't just plug in a microphone and have it work. And then USB came along, and there was a common protocol for plugging things into this device that made a lot of those product experiences a lot easier. And I really hope that we kind of get past this and that we have a more plug-and-play kind of model for the home, so that if you wanted to do those things, you could. But I think that the part of me that kind of worries a little bit is that there's a lot of tactile experiences. For example, a light switch, right? There's something very kind of fundamental about just flicking it and having it go on. That's a physical experience. Once that gets removed with automation and using your voice, it becomes a little bit trickier to understand, but there's also benefits. I can be playing with my son on the floor and just, ask to turn on a song without having to get up. And so it's a fine balance. I'd like to think that, the future won't be kind of Jetsons level automation, but we'll probably find some, happy medium where we are offered the efficiencies and kind of the the things that we want to do that are easier to do, and that'll make our lives better. But we won't kind of go full in on having everything being automated and kind of preemptively there for us. So, for example, I don't think that I would want the water to boil for me before I woke up, you know. I think that I want to maintain control. And I think that users are going to want to maintain control as we move into that future.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think that the idea that you have some say over your environment and what's happening in it.
Yeah.
Well, Michael Delgadio, I want to thank you so much for stopping by. Next time you're back in town, please stop by. We'll have another conversation.
Okay, excellent. Thanks for having me.
Michael Delgadio is the UX or User Experience Design Lead for Google. The 2001 MIAD graduate was back at his alma mater this week to work with students and give a lecture as part of the MIAD Creativity Series. You'll find a link to more about his work at WUWM.com.